This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The first question comes from Sean Mulcahy, who asks, how often is the Lovell telescope struck by lightning each year, and does this have any effect on the scientific instruments?
Okay, very good question. In fact, I did a quick poll of telescope controllers today to see what they would tell me. And Mirza, who's worked at Jodrell for about 10 years or so, says he's never seen a lightning strike on the Lovell telescope. And Mark, who's been at Jodrell for 28 years, says he's seen two lightning strikes on the Lovell telescope while he's been there. And he says what you get is a massive big flash, a very loud bang, scares the living daylights out of him. but there were no problems operationally. So it didn't actually affect anything as a result of that. Now, I guess that's probably partly because it's covered in lightning conductors. I did have a word with the electrician as well, to see, but he just said, oh, it's covered in lightning conductors.
So there probably are strikes, but they don't actually hit the telescope itself.
Yeah, so they certainly don't cause a problem with the receiver and things. So, and he also said that in fact, there's probably less strikes than you might think, because relatively near to the telescope, there's a big 150 foot high mast, which has, well, it has an internet connection with a microwave radio link, but it also has, the old microwave radio links for Merlin to the remote telescopes. Oh. And that mast being a sort of narrow, sort of pointy structure, is more likely to attract the lightning strikes. And the Lovell telescope is generally a fairly big sort of amorphous structure, so it's not really too pointy, certainly compared to these masts that are nearby. So he thinks that might be another reason why. They apparently do have rules. If there's a thunderstorm coming, the controller won't, people aren't allowed to get off the structure or onto the structure of the telescope. Right. So if you're on there, you're stuck on there.
Would you be safe?
Well, I think so, because it's not going to go to ground through you. So I think the problem is like jumping off and like then giving a link to ground so the strike might go through you on the way to ground as you sort of step off. So I think that's the idea behind that. Ben in the Pulsar group also says that LOFAR does, you know, the sort of array of radio antenna in the Netherlands and beyond now, does have lightning strikes, and they tend to hit the control buildings, which are actually, it's very flat out in Holland, as you probably were, and the control buildings are about the highest bits around, and they do get lightning strikes, and they do see it in their data as well at low frequencies, which is perhaps where it'd have more of an effect from the thunderstorms as well, I think. But there you go. There are occasional lightning strikes, but not very often. And if there are any smaller ones, the lightning conductors help us out.
If it struck directly onto the antenna, you might think it would fry the electronics. Are they saying that doesn't really happen?
Well, I think it's all in a box. So certainly, as far as I'm aware, that doesn't happen. So it's almost like there's a sort of Faraday cage. There's a metal box around the focus box around the receiver. So I guess it's probably unlikely for that to happen. It's sort of directed away from that, basically.
Well, the second question is from Charles Woolley and takes us a lot further out, way out into the solar system. He says, everyone keeps talking about the Oort cloud as the source of all comets, but every comet that I've heard about seems to come from the Kuiper belt. Has anyone discovered a comet that comes from the Oort cloud?
Yeah, so there's lots of different... I mean, first of all, we should probably say what the Oort cloud is.
Yeah.
The Oort cloud's named after a Dutch astronomer, I think he was, actually, Jan Oort, who first came up with the idea. And the idea is there's this big reservoir of comets at very large distances from the sort of solar system as we think of it, the sort of planetary region of the solar system. So way out beyond, you know, Neptune and Pluto and Eris and these other things. In fact, a very large fraction of the way to the nearest other star, in fact. Now, the reason he came up with that idea sort of explains, really answers Charles's question, I guess, because when you look at comets, you can sort of attempt to measure the periods. Some comets return on observable timescales, so the classic being Halley's Comet, which is 76 years, if I remember rightly,
its
period. So, you know, even in the course of one human life, you might be lucky enough to see two appearances of Halley's Comet. I was lucky enough to see one in 1986, but I doubt I'll see the next one. You've basically got there's a relatively short period comet, and you can work out the sort of size of the orbit. So just from, you know, knowing that, for example, you know, the Earth takes a year to go around the Sun and it's a typical distance from the Sun we call one astronomical unit, you can work out what the distance from the Sun would be for the sort of what's called the semi-major axis, the basically the, you know, roughly the average radius of the orbit of the comet. And those things, those sort of relatively short period comets, do indeed originate from regions often around Jupiter's orbit, because Jupiter's been perturbing them, but also into this Kuiper belt, which is beyond Neptune. Now, there's also very long period comets, and the sort of proper definition, I think, is that long period comets have got orbital periods greater than 200 years. But it's thought, and of course, you know, this is from observations of them and no one person has watched them for thousands of years, but it's thought that those periods can extend up to millions of years from looking at the, you know, the parameters of the orbit. So there's an example, sort of looking up some examples. One example is Comet West, which there's some beautiful photographs of from the mid-1970s with a really spectacular tail. And Comet West, the estimates of its period are sort of range from hundreds of thousands to millions of years. And if you work out what size its orbit would be, that gives it a semi-major axis, a sort of typical radius of orbit of tens of thousands of astronomical units, or tens of thousands of times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So that puts it way out beyond Neptune, Pluto, and so on. And that would be an example of one that would be thought to have originated in the Oort cloud.
Right.
And the other thing you see with these long-period comets is that their orbits are sort of at lots of different inclinations relative to the plane of the planet's orbits. So they're sort of coming from all directions, if you like. And so the idea is the Oort cloud is roughly spherical, whereas the Kuiper belt is sort of flattened. And so a lot of these shorter period comets, unless they've been perturbed by the planets, tend to have orbits that are more closely in the plane of the solar system. So I think the answer is there are comets that we think come from the Oort cloud. They're the long period comets. But the problem is we haven't directly detected the Oort cloud. So we haven't taken pictures of the Oort cloud. It's not detectable at that distance with the size of objects we're talking about. So it's basically to do with looking at the orbits of these things and calculating them back, working out what the size of the orbit would be and postulating the existence of this reservoir of comets.
Right. So we think they've, because we can see them, we think they've come from somewhere, and that tracing it back.
Yeah. And they appear to be bound to the solar system, so they're not, you know, as far as you can tell, for at least some of them anyway, they're not coming from interstellar space. They're actually sort of bound gravitationally to the solar system, but the size of their orbit is huge compared to the size of the planet's orbit, which you get from measuring the period.
So is the Oort cloud dangerous if it's sending these things in? It feels like a game of Space Invaders, where it's kind of pinging in these comets occasionally into the inner solar system.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure. I think the idea is that the Oort cloud probably didn't form out at that distance. It probably is, the comets maybe were scattered out to that distance by perturbations in the solar system earlier on. I think passing stars, so, you know, as the Sun orbits the Milky Way, passing stars may well perturb the Oort cloud and drop a comet in. So they're the dangerous comets. They're the ones that, you know, we sort of know the periodic ones. We can measure the orbits and we can sort of predict when they come close to the Earth, but it's the one that falls in that you've never seen before and suddenly appears coming out of the Sun, so you can't even see it at night, and head straight towards Earth. That would be the planet killer, I guess.
Right.
Sleep well.
We get at least a few years' notice, wouldn't we?
Well, I'm not sure. I think if you were really unlucky, if you picked one that was coming towards us from the direction of the Sun, maybe there's a way of doing it so you wouldn't actually see it. You wouldn't get much warning.
Right. Interesting. Well, on that note, let's go even further out. Ernie Stevenson has asked a question about galaxies, such as Andromeda, and says these galaxies are many thousands of light years across. And given that the fastest rate at which information is carried is the speed of light, how can such big objects exhibit a coherent structure? Is there a difference then between different sides of such a large object as a galaxy, or is their structure a consequence of their evolutionary timescale?
Okay, yeah, I think there's a couple of things there that Ernie's getting at, really. He's right to say that galaxies are huge. So, for example, you know, maybe 100,000 light years across for the visible disk. Mm. So, if you were to look at a galaxy like Andromeda, and you looked at, I guess it was edge on, and you looked at the far edge, that light would have taken 100,000 years longer than the light from the near edge. Now, of course, it's sort of tilted at a bit of an angle, so it's more like 50, 60,000 years difference. Now, in terms of if you think about the stars that make up that disk, let's say, then yeah, the evolutionary lifetime of a star is much longer than 50,000 years. So in general, you know, even the most massive stars probably live their lives in the course of, say, 10 million years or something. So you won't see much difference really between one side of a galaxy and the other in those terms. But I think more, you know, another thing to think about is the galaxies rotating. So you could say, okay, you know, when you look at these nice spiral structures you see in galaxies and things, is there a sort of light travel time delay effect that would warp the appearance of it, because you'd be seeing the far side of it farther in the past than the near side of it? So I just worked that out what sort of magnitude of effect you get. And for Andromeda in particular, its orbital period, the length of time it takes for it to rotate once, is about 250 million years. Basically, you can measure the speeds of things like H2 regions, which are these, these regions of ionized gas around young stars, and you can measure the spectrum, measure the Doppler shift of the lines in the spectrum so you can actually measure speeds of things. They're moving at about 250 kilometers per second, which is fast.
Yes.
In a sort of circular velocity, if you like, around the galaxy. But they've got a long way to travel. They're at a radius of about 30,000 light years or so, those particular ones from the middle. So if you work out how long it takes them to go around once, it's a long time, 250 million years. So when you think that the sort of light crossing time from the back far side of the galaxy to the near side is 50, 60,000 years or something, it's that fraction of 250 million years you've got to work out. And it's basically 0.02% of the orbital period.
Right.
So if you think about what, you know, it's only moved round 0.02% of the way around the circle, if you like, in the time it takes the light to travel from one side to the other. So again, I think it's just not, you know, it's certainly not, it wouldn't be discernible on looking at a picture of the overall structure of the galaxy.
Yeah. And I guess what we're saying is that it can be a coherent structure, but you wouldn't expect to see any large-scale changes in less than 66,000 years, the light crossing time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, well, from far away, let's go to everywhere. We have a question from Jeff Mutton about dark matter, and he says, if the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background are caused by cold dark matter, how is it that that is so cold when the baryonic or normal matter at that time was in thermal equilibrium with radiation and was therefore very hot?
Right. Okay. So, let's just sort of reiterate, I guess, what this is all about. The cosmic microwave background is this light that we see now in the radio part of the spectrum that was produced, we think about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And we measure its temperature. Effectively, its brightness all over the sky, and it's basically roughly the same temperature all over the sky, which is why we say that it's in this sort of equilibrium. And so the matter and the radiation are in this sort of equilibrium. The radiation had the temperature of the universe basically at that time was about 3,000 degrees, so relatively warm. That's not hot in astrophysical terms, but relatively warm. And there are little tiny fluctuations in this temperature. And those little tiny fluctuations, as Jeff says, are to do with the effects of cold dark matter. And I guess what he's saying is, how come the dark matter is cold, but the radiation and the normal matter, the other matter there, is hot, at least at 3,000 degrees?
Yeah, thermodynamics would put them at similar temperatures.
Right. So the problem, two things here. First of all, the term cold dark matter is a bit of a confusing one, I guess, because the cold doesn't necessarily mean what you might think it might mean. It was a term that came about because there's also an idea called hot dark matter. And hot dark matter was a type of dark matter that was postulated to have particles that were moving around at very close to the speed of light. And because we think of temperatures basically measured by the speed at which the particles move in anything, that was termed hot dark matter. And then there was an idea that was things like neutrinos, which are moving if not at the speed of light, very close to the speed of light. Then there's this idea of cold dark matter, which are things like WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, which move more slowly, not relativistically. And they're so, by contrast, they were called cold dark matter. That doesn't mean to say it's cold. You know, in fact, how you would define its temperature, it's not really the same thing as talking about a thermodynamic temperature in the same way as we do with other things. But the other reason, that the explanation really for this is that, this type of dark matter, this type of what we call non-baryonic dark matter, like these WIMPs, is collisionless. We say it's collisionless, which means that it doesn't interact in the same way as other normal matter does via electromagnetic forces, for example. It does feel gravity, but it doesn't feel these other forces, which are the sort of forces that, you know, stop my hand going through this wall here, for example.
Or let's just bang the wall of the studio there. Interacted strongly.
Or even this microphone. The reason I can't put my hand through that is because of electromagnetic forces.
Okay.
So these weakly interacting massive particles, they don't feel those forces, and so they're much less, you know, they don't feel collisions in the same way, although they do feel gravity. Now, what it means in the early universe is that before recombination, while the universe was still ionized, before the cosmic microwave background was emitted, there was lots of electrons, lots of photons flying around. The photons were scattering off the electrons. And that means that those photons, that light, that radiation, exerts a pressure on the gas, which has the electrons in it, the ionized gas. And that stops that gas collapsing to form structures, because it would want to collapse under its own weight. But the pressure of the radiation exerted by these photons interacting with the electrons holds it up from being collapsing. But you don't get the same interaction between the radiation and the cold dark matter particles, because they don't feel this electromagnetic force.
Right, so radiation's nothing to them.
Nothing, yeah, that's right. So they just feel their own gravity. Mm. And they do collapse on themselves. And they start to form these, what we call gravitational potential wells. They start to form the seeds, basically, for the structures. But they're basically just made of cold dark matter. And then what happens is the universe expands and it recombines. So the electrons and the protons recombine to form neutral hydrogen. The universe becomes transparent. The photons stream out freely. That's what forms the microwave background we see now. And at that point, the normal gas, the baryonic gas, because there isn't this radiation pressure anymore, the photons aren't hitting the free electrons because the electrons have recombined to make the hydrogen. That normal gas is able to start to collapse in on itself. And so it falls into the gravitational potential wells that have already been formed by the dark matter.
Okay.
And that all got around this problem with that we see structures now, but those structures wouldn't have had time to form from in the age of the universe from the Big Bang to now if they only started forming after recombination, so after the microwave background was emitted.
Right.
There wasn't time for it to have happened, so there had to have been this seeding process of the dark matter halos, these gravitational potential wells.
So there's more indirect evidence for dark matter.
Yep.
Again.
Yep, certainly all part of the complex model that does still hang together largely, that explains these things.
Well, a slightly related question, or at least related to what you were just talking about, is the last one from Richard Elvin. And he says, after the Big Bang, the universe cooled and was able to form neutral hydrogen. And then there was reionization when ultraviolet radiation from the first stars heated the universe up again. Assuming that the universe is open and will expand forever, will there ever be a point where it deionizes again on the way to heat death?
Right, okay, yeah, it does follow on quite well from the last question. So basically we talked about this idea that the universe was ionized, and so just think about it as hydrogen. There's just electrons and protons separated. And then as it expands out and cools down, they can, they say recombine, and it's a silly name really, recombination, because it wasn't that it was combined before, so it's not really recombining.
Okay.
It's combining for the first time. Mm-hmm. The electrons and the protons come together to make hydrogen atoms, neutral hydrogen atoms. But yeah, then you get a period of the universe we call the Dark Ages, before the first stars were formed. So then you've got that process where you've got those dark matter halos, those gravitational potential wells, all the normal baryonic matter can start collapsing in once the universe has become neutral, once after the cosmic microwave background has been emitted. And that can start, you know, the stuff collapses in, it gets denser, The gas actually heats up and then cools by radiation, and you can start to form denser and denser objects, and you can form the first stars. Now, the first stars light up, and they're hot, probably massive. They're called Population 3 stars. We've not yet seen them, but we hope to in the future. Mm-hmm. And that the ultraviolet light from those floods out from these new stars that are lit up, pinged on, like light bulbs switching on all over the universe. And that ionizes this neutral hydrogen again. Now, he's asking, will they ever deionize? And in fact, that we could call that recombine again.
Right, it would be a recombination this time.
Yeah, it would.
Combine for the second time.
Yeah. So, at the moment, if you look at, say, something like the Milky Way, then the Milky Way's got this interstellar medium, the gas between the stars, and it's made up of, there's lots of different phases of it. So there's like a hot phase and a warm phase and a cool phase. In fact, most of the volume of the Milky Way between the stars is made up of ionized hydrogen. But not most of the mass of the interstellar medium, actually. Most of the mass of the interstellar medium is actually in the form of molecular hydrogen and neutral hydrogen, atomic hydrogen, that has, you know, recombined.
Uh-huh.
And that's in dense clouds. So basically you've got this sort of low density, hotter, ionized stuff, mm-hmm. and then embedded within it these sort of colder clouds of denser, neutral and molecular stuff. So there is ionized stuff around, and the question is whether, and in fact between the galaxies there's ionized hydrogen as well, but even lower densities than it is within the galaxies. So the question is whether as the universe expands and expands and expands, assuming it never recollapses again, and all the stars start to die out and we all have this horrible cold, death in the future, the heat death of the universe.
A long way in the future though.
It's a long way in the future, hopefully. then, will stuff recombine again? And in fact, you can work out how long it would take for a given set of particles to recombine. You've basically got electrons and protons flying around. And you can sort of imagine if they're going to come together and stick together to make a neutral hydrogen atom, two things have to be the case. One is, if it's very hot, they're flying around very fast, it's harder to make them stick together.
Mm-hmm.
So the cooler the gas is, the more likely it is to happen. And the other is, it needs to be dense, the gas, because if it's low density, the chances of them coming close enough are very low. So it's affected by the temperature you've got and the density you've got. If you're inside a galaxy, although the universe is expanding, the galaxy itself isn't expanding, so the density is not really going to change. And in fact, you maybe probably don't expect the temperature to change either. So it's not like the expansion of the universe will cause the space within a galaxy to expand and get less dense and cooler. So you've got to really just think about it and say, okay, well, what will happen as, for example, the stars burn out and maybe you run out of material to form new stars or something. So if that were to happen, you can work out how long it would take. The density of the interstellar medium, it's about one particle per cubic centimetre. So if you imagine a little block, little dice or something, a die, mm-hmm. 1 centimetre by 1 centimetre by 1 centimetre, in the interstellar medium, typically, you might get one particle in that space.
Which is a very low density.
It's very low. I mean, compared to water, if you had the same amount of water, a little cubic centimetre of water, there's 10 to the 23. So right. that's a 1 followed by 23 zeros atoms in that. So there's only one in these. So very low density. It would take, at that density, it takes the interstellar medium about 100,000 years to recombine. Now, that's a long time, but short on the timescale of a galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, in say, a galaxy like the Milky Way, the interstellar medium is being kept ionized by light from stars and the motions of stars and gas clouds that sort of cause shocks and things that keep it ionized. So, actually, you know, if you were to turn off all those sources of ionizing radiation, say, then it would take something like 100,000 years for gas of that density to recombine.
Right.
So yeah, I guess when the stars die out and things, it will deionize on its way to heat death.
Yeah, because as the universe gets older, we can observe that there is, on average, less star formation, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So
yeah.
It's not a limitless process of recycling.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not just that things are forming out of stars and then everything's, you know, when the star dies, not all the material it's made of is recycled back into the interstellar medium. So yeah, it's not an endless process.
But if it was expanding forever because of dark energy, would there come a point when the expansion with the dark energy would just rip everything apart, even the atoms themselves?
Oh, I don't know. Good question. I don't know, actually. I don't really know enough about dark energy to know the answer to that.
You don't even know if it exists, really.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the thing, you know, what you're referring to really is what I was saying about the fact that, you know, when you think about an expanding universe, you know, the space between me and you now is not, I'm not getting farther away from you because of the expansion of the universe.
No.
Because on these sorts of size scales, the gravity completely dominates, or, and other forces, of course, on our size scales, electromagnetic forces, on the size scales of solar systems and individual galaxies, they're not expanding because of the expansion of the universe. But I guess your question is, what does dark energy do to that? I don't know.
In the very, very, very long run, yeah.
Let's get a dark energy expert to answer that for us. Probably we don't know enough about the way dark energy works.
Well, on the cheery topic of heat death of the universe, I'll sign off. Thanks very much.
That's no problem.